Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell, filling in for Aggie Tupo. Today on the show, South Pacific defence ministers want to transform a military disaster response group into a task force that could also conduct Pacific stabilisation missions in a move that could stir controversy in the region. Our foreign affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts will join the show shortly with the latest update on this development. And as Pacific Islands race to contain the largest dengue fever outbreak in a decade, new research has identified the role that weather patterns and travel have in the spread of the virus.
We found that the beginning of a dengue outbreak in these Pacific Islands is largely explained by a combination of minimum temperature from 2 months ago and global arrivals of humans from non-Pacific Island countries into the Pacific Islands.
Also, the first member of a group of former immigration detainees in Australia has been quietly deported to Nauru.
They don't have enough food to eat, that their healthcare is insufficient, and their human rights aren't being upheld.
Those stories and more here on Pacific Beat, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
But first, one of the Pacific's most high-profile leaders is pressing Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese to fly to the global UN climate summit in Brazil next month to close the deal with Turkey and secure hosting rights for next year's meeting. Australia has been stuck in protracted negotiations with Turkey as the two countries try to hammer out a compromise which will allow Australia to host the Conference of Parties climate change meeting with Pacific nations in 2026. The president of Palau, Soronga Whips Jr., says it's crunch time for the summit. And he tells foreign affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts that Mr. Albanese should travel to the Amazonian city of Belém for COP30 if needed to convince Turkey to clear the way for Australia's bid.
The bottom line is it is crunch time. We're 12 months away. And this is an important event, and Australia needs all the time to prepare and get ready for it. And really, it's important for Turkey to clear the way, and so preparations can begin. I do know that Australia has put a number of proposals forward to Turkey, and I think it's important that they look at them really clear the way so that we can avoid an impasse and possibly a major distraction in Brazil at COP30 over this issue.
And why is it important? Do you believe then it should be sorted before COP30 in Brazil, ideally, at least an in-principle agreement, so there isn't wrangling in Brazil?
Absolutely. I mean, every day counts. And the sooner we can get this done, the better. But it's also important that we have to get it done, and if it ends up that we have to go to Brazil, let's get it done quickly, so that we don't dwell on it. And I do hope that Prime Minister Albanese and the Pacific leaders are there to do all we can to help Turkey work a solution that we can all have a successful COP31.
Mr. Albanese hasn't yet confirmed if he'll travel to Belém, although the expectation around Canberra is that he might well. Why do you think it's important he attend?
Well, you know, his voice, his presence there, I think it just represents the importance of a Pacific COP. And hopefully can push Turkey over the line. you know, some of those proposals that Turkey has to have a co-presidency. I mean, this is something that we know can't work, and we need to be able to have Turkey understand those. We also need them to understand that when we talk about a Pacific COP, there needs to be a hosting of some kind of pre-COP, possibly in Fiji or somewhere in the Pacific. Palau is hosting the Pacific Island Forum's leader meeting next year, leaders meeting next year, and this is another opportunity for leaders to get together before COP. So these are things that I think really need to be fleshed out, and hopefully Turkey can understand how important this is to the Pacific, how important it is that we bring COP to the Pacific, because we believe that, you know, unlike other countries in the world, when they talk about climate change, they may be only talking about droughts, or they may be only talking about sea level rise, or they may be only talking about storms. On the Pacific, we experience all of them, including coral bleaching and fish disappearing and other issues that are affecting us. And that's why it's important that we get the opportunity to make this a Pacific COP and really focus on Oceania, which never has been done before.
What do you, I mean, it's difficult from this distance to work out exactly what the blockage is with Turkey. The assumption at first is that they wanted something else, but it seems increasingly clear that there's a point of pride, that they felt they were promised something ahead of Glasgow that was then not delivered. Are you hopeful that your argument about the Pacific's moral authority will be enough to convince Turkey to accept, at the very least, one of these compromises?
We would hope that Turkey really sees the importance that the leader, that the Pacific has played in leading by example, and also the impacts that we are currently facing. Those are the two, I think, strong points that, of bringing the COP to the Pacific. And then the other thing is, you know, we've been in Azerbaijan, we've been in the UAE, and we've been in Sharm el-Sheikh in the last 3 years. Turkey is right in the middle of all those three countries. We're going to go to Brazil, and we'll be talking about the Amazon and the rainforest. And we really think it's important that we talk about oceans and the importance of oceans also. So this is not only a Pacific COP, but also a blue COP. I think we often overlook our second lung, which is the oceans. When it comes to climate, they are so important. And we know that healthy oceans mean a healthy planet.
And just final question, sir. Mr. Albanese, of course, as is pretty well known, holidayed in Palau when he took his week of leave. Did you have a chance to catch up with him? And did you discuss the COP bid whilst he was on his holiday and the best way forward?
Well, he was on his holiday, but it was definitely great to be able to have him in Palau and actually show him the challenges we have. You know, we went out to the beach and we collected a plastic that washed up from our neighbors. We looked at places that had coastal erosion caused by sea level rise and storms. And you know, of course, I said, this is what we need to show our friends from around the world so they understand the challenges that we face. And yes, we did have an opportunity to chat a bit about how we need to work together to ensure that we get this COP31 a bit over the line.
Palau's President Soerangel Whips Jr. speaking to Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts there.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, South Pacific defence ministers want to transform a military disaster response group into a task force that could also conduct Pacific stabilisation missions in a move that could stir controversy in the region. The shift was flagged at last week's South Pacific defence ministers meeting in Chile. The SPDMM involves Australia, Chile, France and New Zealand, as well as the three Pacific Island nations with standing militaries, Papua New Guinea, Fiji and Tonga. The proposal would mark an ambitious expansion of the Pacific Response Group's merit just a year after it was created to help respond to humanitarian catastrophes. And for more, I'm joined now by Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgett. Stephen, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Jordan.
It's early. Stephen, first, let's head into what exactly is the Pacific Response Group and how does this new concept take it further than what is already currently the case?
Right. So the Pacific Response Group is a relatively recent creation. It was first flagged when the South Pacific Defence Ministers met in 2023. And then it was officially set up in 2024. It's essentially a multinational defence response group. In other words, it's headquartered in Brisbane, and it's designed to basically help out with disaster response. It's fairly modest in scale, and we've only really seen it used once or twice since it's been set up. We saw, for example, some advisors, not troops, but advisors connected with the PRG, sent to help in the wake of the devastating earthquake at the end of 2024 in Vanuatu. We've also seen the PRG play a role in a couple of French-led military exercises in the region. But in a way, it is only just getting started. And the idea initially when this was pitched was basically that the PRG would be another body that could be used to help when there was a natural disaster in the region. It could basically provide another avenue for countries across the region, including from those a little further afield, like Chile, that are part of the SPDMM but not part of other regional mechanisms, that allows them to play a role to help. But what we saw last week when the ministers met was basically them flagging something quite different. The ministers told their respective defence chiefs that it was time to evolve the Pacific Response Group, and they told the defence chiefs to look at options to expand its mandate beyond just disaster relief, so it could also conduct what they've called stabilisation missions if necessary. And not only that, they also said, can you help look agreements we might need, a status of forces agreement and other arrangements that would be necessary to smooth the path legally for this to occur. So what seems to be happening here is that the PRG in its infancy already is adapting pretty rapidly into something more expansive and more ambitious that could, if it's ticked off by both Pacific nations, probably PIF, and most importantly, of course, by the SPDMM, evolve into something much more sweeping that would see a pretty significant shift in the way that the region responds to not just disasters, but also to unrest.
And with that unrest and that idea of it being a stabilization task force, do we know anything about the motivation? What's kicked this off, this idea of this expansion of the response group?
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of things are going on. The first thing, perhaps, is that, you know, there's a desire to bring in, perhaps in particular, Chile and France into regional responses in a more sort of systematic way. And not only that, to bring the resources that they could potentially bring to bear into the frame. So, you know, obviously, when there has been unrest before, we've already seen regional responses. So the most famous, I guess, instances of that were in Solomon Islands, both at the Ramsey intervention that Australia led in 2003, and then the multinational or Pacific response that we saw, again, led by Australia after the riots in 2021. So we have seen the region respond collectively before in Australia and New Zealand. But what this is flagging is that Australia is saying, okay, we need to bring in others, and New Zealand as well. We need to bring in other countries, perhaps with more resources, who would also be willing to help in the event of some sort of form of unrest. So that's one of the things that you can do. One, bring in more resources. The second thing, though, I think is undeniably also about trying to center Australia, New Zealand, and France, to a degree Chile, into the very heart of Pacific security-making decisions. And there is undeniably an element of strategic denial here as well. China, as we know, and as we've discussed, Jordan has been angling to play a more prominent role in the security of the Pacific, particularly in the policing space. But Australia's belief is that they're also angling for a military foothold. And the last thing that Australia wants to see, if there is future unrest in a place like Solomon Islands or in another part of the Pacific, the last thing Australia wants to see is China offering and being given a role in that response as well. That might create facts on the ground that Australia might not want to see. So by creating a mechanism like this, Australia and others are saying, look, we can draw on the resources of others, including other substantial, you know, military powers like France, and make sure that we can draw on them and their resources, which means that there's no need for countries to turn to China. Now, I hasten to add, you know, no one's going to be charging in. You're not going to see French paratroopers charging into Vanuatu or Melanesia or anywhere in the Pacific without specific permission from those countries. Those countries will have to request help, as they do already, and would have to agree to it. But you can see what Australia is trying to do here. Again, this is part of what some academics say is sort of the hub and spokes model. You know, with Australia at the hub, it's trying to really build up its own presence as the main security partner of the Pacific, and trying to exclude China.
And this idea, how likely do you think it will be? How likely do you think it will go down with the wider Pacific, especially around the work being done in the Pacific Islands Forum, which Chile and France are not members of?
Yeah, and this is the slightly awkward element here for Australia and New Zealand. You know, Australia and New Zealand talk all the time, with good reason, about the need for the Pacific family to take the lead on security issues. And they've basically said if there are any security issues, then the Pacific should take the lead, and Pacific Islands Forum leaders, or Pacific Island Forum members, should take the lead. Now, of course, France is a resident power in the Pacific. It's got its territories, effectively, of New Caledonia and French Polynesia. But as you know, Jordan, this is a very complicated and sometimes contentious issue. Some Pacific nations have said very clearly they think France should withdraw from the Pacific. It should give independence to New Caledonia and French Polynesia. And there's been enormous unrest on that very question inside New Caledonia. So the prospect of France coming in as part of a broader regional stabilization mission might prove a little bit contentious in some Pacific nations. That said, it's worth noting three Pacific nations have evidently already endorsed this, namely PNG, Tonga, PNG, Tonga and Fiji, the three countries that have standing militaries. So there's a level of buy-in, it seems, from the Pacific, but there's a reason, I suspect, that Baron Wonga, the Pacific Islands Forum Secretary General, was invited to this meeting in Chile. Australia and others really will need to make sure that they get that institutional buy-in, not just from PIF, but also from other Pacific nations that might regard this suspiciously or see it as nothing more than another mechanism to block China from the region. So we'll have to wait and see how it goes and what the reception is like. But again, obviously, this is a pretty ambitious move, and it's one that that the Australian government at least believes that it can carry off.
Where to next with the Pacific Response Group, and especially with this proposal to move into stabilization missions?
Well, next thing will be the chiefs of all the defence forces basically working out how this would work. That's the work that you'd imagine would be done over the next 12 months before the next meeting of Pacific defence ministers. My guess, and it's just a guess, is that they'll come back to defence ministers with a concrete proposal, which they'd hope then would be endorsed by those defence ministers at the next Pacific defence ministers meeting. And then that would basically provide the framework that would be necessary for this Pacific Response Group to effectively be on hand as an option in the event of unrest. Again, it doesn't mean it's necessarily going to happen the next time there's some sort of blow up in the Pacific, But at least in theory, the PRG could be ready to go if that framework is endorsed by the ministers. But I think it will also need effective endorsement from the Pacific Islands Forum as well, not just the Secretariat. And interestingly, there's a proposal to embed a PRG officer with the PIF Secretariat to improve communications and to get their buy-in, but also from Pacific leaders. I would imagine that that members of the South Pacific Defence Ministers meeting will want to get an in principle at least approval from Pacific leaders when they gather next year at the PIF leaders meeting in Palau next year. They'll want and need that sign off at every level, I imagine, in order to give this proposal Pacific-wide legitimacy. So that's where some of the work might need to be done. Australia and other countries, including Fiji and PNG, who believe it's a good idea, will need to have conversations, perhaps privately and quietly, with other Pacific countries to explain what they're doing here, convince them that it's a good idea, and to effectively get this over the line.
Be very interesting to see how it all unfolds. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
No problem. Thanks, Jordan.
That was our foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgett, speaking with me there.
Pacific Beat.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat on this Wednesday morning. Now, the first member of a group of former immigration detainees in Australia has been quietly deported to Nauru. The group were released into the community following a high court ruled their indefinite detention was illegal, and Australia's signed a deal with Nauru for the hundreds of other former detainees to eventually also go to the Pacific Island. But when they'll be deported and how much the deal will cost Australian taxpayers remains shrouded in secrecy. The ABC's political reporter Adam Langenberg has the story.
News from Nauru doesn't travel quickly. 5 days ago, the tiny Pacific Islands president announced that the first member of Australia's so-called NZYQ cohort had been deported there. And on Tuesday, reports of the immigration detainees' arrival finally emerged in Australia.
I think Australians are owed some transparency around this.
That's Shadow Home Affairs Minister Jonathan Dunningham. He wants answers to several key questions, including when the bulk of the group will be deported and whether taxpayer money has already been paid to Nauru as part of a deal to take hundreds of immigration detainees from Australia.
The deal itself, it's hard to say whether it's a good one or not because they won't give us the detail.
The NZYQ cohort refers to a group of about 350 former detainees who were released into the community after a high court ruling found their indefinite detention was unlawful. They're all non-citizens. Most of them have been convicted of crimes or had their visas cancelled on character grounds. Earlier this year, Nauru agreed for the group to be settled there in a deal the Australian government is happy to spruik.
Until that was there, we had a situation where for some people, no matter what laws they'd broken, cancelling a visa was meaningless.
That's Immigration Minister Tony Burke on Insiders earlier this month. He's refused to release the terms of the 30-year agreement publicly, but department officials have revealed Australia will pay Nauru an initial $408 million after the first deportee arrives. And the deal could end up costing billions of dollars, depending on how many of the cohort end up being sent to Nauru. Greens MP David Shoebridge.
We don't know how much money is being paid to Nauru. We don't know if that's on a per person being deported there.
He says he's incredibly concerned that Nauru is not safe for the people who will be deported there. That's a concern shared by Jana Favero from the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre.
I acknowledge that Minister Burke has said that the conditions are excellent in his eyes, but with absolutely no transparency around it, no one to visit, you have to pay $8,000 just to apply for a visa. It's impossible to know exactly what the conditions are.
But she says reports from asylum seekers transferred to Nauru over the years don't have many nice things to say about their lives there.
They don't have enough food to eat, that their healthcare is insufficient, and their human rights aren't being upheld.
The ABC has asked Tony Burke a series of questions, including how many of the NZYQ cohort are currently in Australian immigration detention, and whether he is satisfied the people sent to Nauru would be safe. But he declined to provide further details, saying only that when someone's visa is cancelled, they should leave.
That report from ABC's political reporter Adam Langenberg.
This is Pacific Beat.
My name is Jordan Fennell. That's right. You're with me here on Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Still to come on the show this morning, two young international soccer players from Solomon Islands are halfway through a pioneering internship with the current A-League Premiers, Auckland FC. And there is hope over time that the new program will open doors for the best Pacific players to secure A-League contracts.
It's been great collaborating with, in particular, Josh Smith at Solomon Islands Football Federation around these two players. Our view at this stage is that we're working with players over 18 from a welfare and safeguarding perspective who come into respective club environments with a chaperone. So Auckland FC have been fantastic, very accommodating. They're interested around growing the game in the region and, of course, looking at talent around the region as well.
Also still to come, a new study has found that more than 70% of fish sampled around Fiji's coastal waters contain microplastics. Coming up, the lead author of that study will join me to speak about the science of microplastics and what this means for Fijians. But first, as Pacific Islands race to contain the largest dengue fever outbreak in a decade, new research has identified the role that weather patterns and travel have in the spread of the virus. A viral infection transmitted between mosquitoes and humans, symptoms present as a high temperature, muscle aches, joint pain, nausea, and vomiting. And the study that was led by James Cook University's Associate Professor in Applied Mathematics, Roslyn Hickson, tells Lucy Cooper it was a collaborative effort.
So my colleagues at James Cook University are part of a DFAT-funded initiative called PAC-MOSSIE, where they're doing capacity building for mosquito surveillance across the Pacific. And they came to us and said, we have this great syndromic surveillance data, and we'd like to understand if mass gathering events are a driver for local outbreaks like everybody thinks they are, or if it's something else.
You used machine learning in the study, I suppose, for our audience, also known as AI. What did you find by using it?
So we found that the beginning of a dengue outbreak in these Pacific islands is largely explained by a combination of minimum temperature from 2 months ago and global arrivals of humans from non-Pacific Island countries into the Pacific Islands.
What role did weather patterns and travel play in the spread of dengue fever?
So back in the study period of 2012 to 2019, so this is historic dengue data that we're looking at, dengue wasn't yet endemic, so it didn't stick around in these countries. So we know that any beginning outbreak was likely caused by human movement into the area. So what we were trying to understand is, you know, some of the nuance around that. And so we divided that travel data into between Pacific Island countries and from other global airports into the Pacific Island countries. And, you know, that ended up being quite explanatory for those beginning months. Mosquitoes are incredibly sensitive to all sorts of weather variables, and especially temperature and rainfall. And so we wanted to include those weather parameters to capture this climate sensitivities of mosquitoes. And that's where we found temperature from 1 to 2 months ago also ended up being the other major explainer of those beginning outbreak months. Now, perhaps interestingly, for an ongoing month, so not the beginning of an outbreak, but a continuation of an existing outbreak, the human movement in wasn't a factor, and it was all about those climatic parameters or the weather variables.
The study found that the average minimum temperature 2 months prior was a really strong predictor of outbreaks. Why is this?
It takes the mosquito populations a little while to ramp up, if you will. So we do know that a lot of the life cycle parameters are highly sensitive to that. So it's likely that combination of having a sufficiently large mosquito population combined with when the humans are arriving from those international or global areas.
Given that human movement triggers outbreaks but doesn't sustain them, how should Pacific Island nations adjust their public health strategies with this in mind?
That's a really complicated question because the situation has changed so much between 2019 and the current outbreaks that they're experiencing. We're seeing a lot more of the sort of ongoing outbreaks that are occurring. But in the countries that don't have those ongoing outbreaks, then it suggests that monitoring carefully predictions of those human travel movements into the areas is going to be really important for understanding when they can get ahead of those mosquito populations with removal of breeding sites and spraying and all of those interventions that they do.
So looking forward, can this research help inform early warning systems or decision support tools for dengue prevention?
I would say there's still a lot of research that needs to happen. We ended up finding that the power of the models wasn't really strong enough to say that these models were predictive, but they were only explanatory. So we think it's a good indicator of where future research efforts need to focus on understanding these outbreaks, and future public health can be looking at those human movements from those global areas into the Pacific. But I wouldn't say that it is yet at a level of maturity to be an early warning system.
That was James Cook University's Associate Professor Roslyn Hickson.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, two young international soccer players from Solomon Islands are halfway through a pioneering internship with the current A-League Premiers Auckland FC. The placement program, devised by the Oceania Football Confederation, is focused on the 18 to 22 age group and aimed at giving male and female players from the Pacific the chance to experience a professional environment. And as Richard Hewitt reports, while there are no guarantees, the hope over time is that the new program will open doors for the best Pacific players to secure A-League contracts.
Goes back to Rovu. Can he finish? Yes, he can. Brilliant finish. Composer. And that's why he's wearing number 10 here. Solomon Islands extend their lead.
Three goals in six appearances so far for Rovu Boyers in Solomon Islands colours, and 12 goals for West Adelaide in NPL South Australia have certainly caught the eye. And now he's finding out firsthand what life might be like as a full-time pro.
Province where we're from is Munda, and currently playing for a national team as an attacking midfielder, 10. And we're currently on a program to train with Auckland, and it's been great so far. Big difference, very big difference compared to semi-pro leagues, and there's a big gap, and hopefully that gap is a closing in if we gain more experiences from outside.
Dave Wright is OFC's high performance consultant, and he's overseeing the placement program, which has paved the way for Rovu and his Solomon's teammate Gordon Iroh to link up with Auckland FC.
It's been great collaborating with, in particular, Josh Smith at Solomon Islands Football Federation around these two players. Our view at this stage is that we're working with players over 18 from a welfare and safeguarding perspective who come into respective club environments with a chaperone. So Auckland FC have been fantastic, very accommodating. They're interested around growing the game in the region and, of course, looking at talent around the region as well.
So if either player impresses enough, a contract is not out of the question, but Dave Wright says that's not the primary objective.
The players have been exposed to around 8 or 9 training sessions as well as attending A-League games in an observational capacity and National League games with the reserve team who they're training with. They're being chaperoned by Benjamin Tatori, who's a bit of a Solomon Islands legend. Benji's now coaching with some of the Solomon Islands national teams. So not only do the players get the benefit of being in the environment for 2 weeks, but Benji gets to be around the coaches too. The players themselves are really enjoying the experience, and we haven't had direct coaching feedback on the players as of yet. That'll be something we seek at the end of the placement. But I have been in touch with the club. They're comfortable. The players have certainly fitted in. And again, watching them myself, there's no doubt they're competing and they're at the level of the players they're training with.
And while at the end of their placement, the two players may well be considered to be not ready yet for the A-League, Auckland FC will also be fielding a team in the new OFC Pro League, and the Solomon Kings will be there too, so perhaps a tug of war for their services. In the meantime, OFC are talking to more clubs on both sides of the Tasman, both amateur and professional, about taking on more Pacific players.
We're looking to get them to partner in a very informal way to say, look, are you open to having players come in and have this experience? And this is the first of its kind under the new banner of this program. So in that sense, so far, it's been a success. And I think in my conversations, at least with Auckland FC, there is certainly a curiosity to continue to understand understand the talent in the region and whether there's some diamonds out there who potentially have futures in the A-League. So I think the main thing is we're opening the dialogue and opening the door to both players and clubs and trying to assist where we can.
And the next contingent to walk through that door will be three female players.
Very important that we get the right players into the right environment and we ensure readiness on their side and also ensure that an appropriate chaperone in the form of a coach or team manager comes and gets the benefit of that experience. We have three girls coming down from Fiji who are Fijian women's international players who are going to go into Eastern Suburbs, which is an amateur club in Auckland who compete in the Women's National League. Their trip is a little bit shorter due to them being called up for the women's national team, but they'll be here for 8 or 9 days. They'll get to train with the Eastern Suburbs women's national team and immerse themselves in the club. So another three players to continue the momentum on this particular initiative.
In the meantime, Robo Boyers is soaking up the professional atmosphere.
I feel very proud and honored, grateful. I'm given this chance for me representing country, and as long as this experience and I'm representing you guys, I'm very happy.
Robo Boyers steps up, penalty taken and well converted. A goal for Robo Boyers, a goal for Solomon Islands.
Solomon Islands international Robo Boyers clearly reveling in the opportunity he's been given through the OFC placement program. And the reporter there was Richard Hewitt.
This is Pacific Beat.
That's right, this is Pacific Beat. My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on this Wednesday morning on ABC Radio Australia. Now heading to Fiji, where a new study has found that more than 70% of fish sampled around the country's coastal waters contain microplastics. Researchers warn this alarming finding could have serious implications for both marine ecosystems and the seafood relied on by thousands of Fijian fishers and consumers. And joining me now is the author of the study, Aseta Drova, from the Centre for Sustainable Futures at the University of the South Pacific. Bula Aseta. Lovely to have you joining the show. Aseta, this is a pretty scary statistic, 70% of fish containing microplastics that you found. Tell me, how did you go about doing this research?
This research was actually funded by the Asia Pacific Network for Global Change Research. It wasn't only conducted here in Fiji, it was also carried out in Tonga, Tuvalu, and Vanuatu, where we closely worked with fishers collecting commonly eaten reef and lagoon fish directly from their fishing grounds. These are the same places where the families go to fish for food or sell their catches. So this was brought back into the labs, it was dissected. The fish were examined. Well, we just removed the guts and we examined the stomach contents to identify any microplastics that were present. This was done using a controlled method to avoid contamination. And it was very much a community-based effort designed to reflect the real exposure risks from fish that people eat on a daily basis.
And these microplastics, we've heard in headlines scientists really looking into microplastics, but can you give us a sense of what they actually are? If people are eating fish and they know that there are microplastics in it, what does that look like and how could it impact them?
Right. Microplastics are tiny plastic pieces. They're smaller than 5 millimeters, so roughly about the size of a grain of rice or even smaller. Under the microscope, what we identified were the different types of microplastics. They were fiber fragments and sometimes they are film-like pieces. They come from everyday sources like clothing fibers, packaging materials, fishing gears, or larger plastic items that break down over time in the ocean. So even if we don't throw rubbish directly into the sea, it often gets there somehow through rivers and runoffs. And fish is an important part of our diet here in the Pacific. The research shows that it doesn't necessarily mean that people should stop eating fish, but that we need to be more aware of how much plastic pollution is ending up in our environment. So the real concern is preventing plastics from reaching the sea in the first place. It's more of an environmental and waste management issue rather than changing diets.
Just sticking on diet, though, because we do know that scientists are still, I guess, in the preliminary stages of understanding how microplastics could impact us. Can you just give us a sense of what we know so far about how it could impact health? Is it something that we should be worried about, knowing that there's such a high statistic about microplastics being in the fish around Fiji's waters?
Right. For now, there is no clear evidence that, you know, on the health impacts of microplastics. But what we are limited to here at the University of the South Pacific under the Center of Sustainable Futures is we have a limited capacity of laboratory activities that we could conduct here in the university. So what we can do is just monitor microplastics within our environment. And so there are other studies that have been conducted within the region on the presence of microplastics in compartments like the ditch, the mangrove systems, seagrass beds, deep lagoons, deep oceans. That's, you know, in terms of health impacts, that's something that we can work together, you know, to see, bring in experts in those areas to come in and then identify those impacts on us as consumers, major consumers of these resources.
And have we seen any response from the Fijian government or environment agencies since the study came out?
We actually, with this project, we work closely with the Ministry of Fisheries, and they have shown quite a lot of interest in the research, and we have we are preparing technical reports from this research that would feed directly into policy and management discussions. And our findings add to the growing evidence from Fiji and also across the Pacific that microplastics are now common in the marine environment. And we hope that this research helps support more informed decision-making on waste management, ocean health, and food security, and encourages stronger Pacific-led actions to tackle plastic pollution.
Esetta Drova, thank you so much for joining us this morning and giving us the details about this very important study looking at microplastics in Fiji's fish. Thank you very much for your time. That was Esetta Drova from the Center for Sustainable Futures at the University of the South Pacific. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat today. Thank you so very much for your company. Pacific Beat will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's at 6 a.m. PNG time. And you can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nisha Daily.